The announcement by the Democratic and Republican chairs of the Congressional Supercommittee that they had failed to reach agreement on cutting the nation's deficit by $1.2 trillion over the next decade was greeted by some with disappointment, but many others were relieved that proposed severe austerity measures were off the table, at least for now. President Obama and congressional legislators from both parties have consistently discussed their desire to reach a so-called grand bargain that would reach deficit reduction targets largely by invoking draconian cuts in benefits for recipients of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid in exchange for some modest tax increases. The deal that brought about the 12-member joint House-Senate supercommittee endowed with extraordinary powers came out of Tea Party Republican obstruction of an extension of the national debt ceiling that many saw as a tactic to extort concessions on budget cuts. This maneuver brought the federal government uncomfortably close to default and resulted in the downgrading of the U.S. bond rating in August. Now, with the failure of the supercommittee, an automatic $1.2 trillion in cuts will be made from both the defense and domestic budgets unless Congress arrives at a new agreement. But while Tea Party politicians push for austerity measures, accompanied by their slogan that government is the enemy, may have gone virtually unchallenged over the last 2 years, the exponential growth of the new Occupy Wall Street movement and the popularity of their message decrying economic inequality and political corruption may have changed the political climate in Washington. The Democrats' uncharacteristic refusal to cave into GOP demands may be attributed to the power of the Occupy movement. Your reporter spoke with Richard Wolf, professor of economics at the New School University's graduate program in international affairs. He assesses the power of the Occupy Wall Street movement and how the European economic crisis could be a preview of the battles ahead here in the U.S.
You know, it wasn't that many months ago that all we heard about was the Tea Party. Now we barely read about the Tea Party. We read about Occupy this, Occupy that, and the next thing. It is extraordinary. They have raised these basic questions about our economic system, the unfairness of it, the 99 versus 1%, but they've had the courage we haven't seen in 50 years in the United States. They are questioning our economic system, capitalism by name, and they're saying it's long overdue. For 50 years, we've debated our educational system, our transportation system. Last year, we had a national debate about our health system. But one thing is off limits. One thing is a taboo, our economic system. So we don't debate and criticize and see if we can do better the way we ought to in a healthy society. We've had a taboo because of the Cold War and because of the kind of hysterical anti-communism that has suffused our country all these years. And this is a movement that is questioning all that and doing it in a straightforward and honest way, resisting the efforts of the authorities to squelch it, of the police to intimidate it. It is amazing what has been done in 2 months, and every sign points to this being a movement in the early stages of changing the United States. And I think it's an incredible time to be alive and to be able to watch, and even better, to participate.
Now, I wonder, from the perspective of someone who's seen movements come and go and protests come and go, do you see what's developed here with the Occupy Wall Street movement as a transformative movement versus a short-lived series of protests?
In the years since I've been born and lived my life in the United States, I've seen protest movements, but most of them have been focused on single issues: the concern for civil liberties, the concern for civil rights, for the right to have your own sexual orientation, for the right of immigrants to have a decent chance at the American dream, and all of that. And I noticed each time that the movements were specific, they were around a single issue, and when they tried to broaden out, they were told, even by their friends, it's too dangerous, don't raise these basic questions about American society, it'll only divide you, it'll get you in trouble. And that's what contributed to keeping the economic system from being subjected to the normal criticism that we use to subject them to other systems to make them better. It was part of a way that even the critics of our society, who were trying to make it better, shied away from facing the economic realities of our system. And this is the first movement I've ever seen that doesn't shy away, that puts it front and center, that says, look, beyond the particular issues we disagree about, 99% of us know in our hearts that this is a system that is making the rich richer and everybody else is having a harder time, and that's basic, and that unites us, and if we focus on that, we can make the biggest, most far-reaching changes that this country needs, and we can do it because we'll all be together. That kind of unity, that kind of overcoming of the fragmentation that has afflicted critical social movements in the past, that is an enormous, transformative new start in the United States.
Well, Professor Wolf, before you go, maybe you can talk about the battle going on right now in Europe over austerity policies that are being foisted on the people of Greece and Italy and Spain and Portugal and Ireland and other nations, and the resistance we see developing in the streets. Where is that battle headed? And do you think that the result of the conflicts in Europe may usher in some new economic structures that will be fair and that will maybe displace the euro as the common currency, but in the end will spare the people of Europe from these draconian policies that are coming down on them from a hierarchy that they don't seem to be able to control?
You know, I think that we ought to pay close attention to Europe, because Europe is shaping up to be our future that we can look at before we arrive at it, and maybe we can navigate our future a little bit better by paying close attention to the pre-war of it in Europe now. Basically, you're seeing in Europe a fundamental civil conflict between the business community, the banks, and the politicians that they control, trying to maintain the power, trying to respond to this crisis, which gets deeper each year, by policies that protect their dominance in the society. And on the other hand, the mass of people who don't see their interests being represented, who see the crisis as an assault on their well-being, who see the government's handling of it a further assault on their well-being, and who have now dug in their heels and said, this crisis is your fault. The recovery you made served only you. You're not now going to make us pay for your failed economic system and your failed political system on top of it. But the punchline here is the exact same battle over the exact same issues is what's going on in the United States. The details are different. The basic story is the same.
That was Richard Wolf, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, now a visiting professor at the New School University's graduate program in international affairs. His latest book is titled Capitalism Hits the Fan. Find links to Professor Wolf's articles on our website at btlonline.org.